Welcome to Guys We Fuck,
the anti-slut shaming podcast.
Yo, you haven't said?
I'm Christina Hutchinson.
I'm Corinne Fisher.
And I'm your disgusting boyfriend.
Bring us your slutty,
your horny, and your shame.
Hey, you a slut?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's talk about fucking.
Hello, fuckers. How you doing? Welcome to another episode of Guys We Fucked.
It's the Anti-Slut-Shaming Podcast. I'm Corinne Fisher.
I'm Christina Hutchinson.
Welcome to the show. You know the drill by now. If you haven't watched that comedy special, you're going to go to youtube.com/guyswefucked without the U in fucked, and you're going to press play when the video comes up of me and Christina, and you're going to laugh your ass off.
Mm-hmm,
and we're going to keep saying this until we hit the number of views that we want to hit.
Yeah.
And you don't know what that is.
So
this could go on forever.
And it probably will. So get used to it, baby. Help us spread the word. And if you are a Luminary subscriber, you already know this. But if you're not, you get two extra bonus episodes of Guys We Fucked per month, all available only for Luminary subscribers. I love these episodes. We go through our inbox. We take the craziest emails. And we also save a lot of our personal stuff for those episodes because, you know, it's a niche audience, feels more safe for us. So if you're not yet a Luminary subscriber, highly recommend it.
Yes, absolutely. And if you you're an independent musician, but you know, don't suck. Send your music to GWF.
Yeah. Have you ever gotten a bad submission?
Sure.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You get them all the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, 100%. But they tried.
But you don't, and you don't play them, right?
No.
Okay.
No, thank you. Yeah. There's some that definitely, like, I'll be like, I dig this, so hopefully this works. But they're different sounding.
Mike likes a whispery folk song.
A Melsey.
I do. Yeah, and I love an electronic, like, dancey, you know.
Okay.
We get a lot of those that I think that end up on the show too.
Well, that's because I think when you, guys, you know, you're creating on a computer because if you don't have the money for instruments,
right?
As an independent artist.
Yeah.
But so, send them to me.
Yeah. So it's a GWF podcast music at gmail.com. You'll be talking to Mike and you need a streaming link and then an MP3.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to send more than one song for submission, just send an MP3 of everything that you're sending just so I can actually download it and put it
You know how to use computers, guys.
Yeah, you got it. You guys are all young.
You can figure it out. And if you want to email us, it's sorryaboutlastnightshow@gmail.com. Make that subject line descriptive. This week's subject line is, would it be that bad? It's about suicide. Mm. Hi, Corinne and Christina.
No.
I go on.
Oh, the subject's about, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Yes, it would.
Yeah, I could go on forever about how much joy you and Guys We Fucked has given me for many years.
Well, not enough.
I was gonna say, already you've like found a reason to live.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Every Friday. Come on. Never missed an episode. After I catch up on each week's new episode, I go through old episodes and I'm listening through for probably the third or fourth time, and it is the best part of my day. That's bad news.
Yeah, that's not great.
I've also seen you live as much as possible when I lived in DC and now in Philadelphia, and your comedy special was amazing.
Thank you.
I'm so appreciative you released it to us for free. Don't get me wrong, I would have paid for it, but it means a lot to me that you produce so much free content, because I think everyone needs a little Guys We Fucked. I can't thank you enough.
Well, that's very nice.
That's what happens when no one wants to buy it, you know?
they're like, oh, Chris DiStefano, well, let's call you.
Anyway. That real, congrats, Chris.
No, yeah, it's awesome.
No, he's amazing. Yeah. I have had suicidal ideation. What's that?
That's just the abbreviation for parentheses, S-I. I thought you were saying C.
Well, I just was like,
yes.
Or some kind of a warning. I was like, I don't know what this warning means. I've had suicidal ideation since the fourth grade, age 9, when 9/11 happened. And I saw that man jumping from the towers and thought, I wish that was me.
Yeah. Oh, no.
That's a fucked up image to see, especially for a 9-year-old.
Way to make 9/11 about you.
True. True. Didn't think of that part.
I didn't understand why I felt this way at the time, but it was very upsetting for 9-year-old me. Also, I used to pray, asking God in quotes to not wake me up in the morning. I have been in and out of hospitals, residential programs, day programs, after work programs, group therapy, and individual therapy, and I take 11 pills a day, which are all psych meds, yet suicidal ideation is still very prevalent in my life. I always gave myself goals, like I will kill myself before I turn 18.
That's not a goal.
No.
That's not a goal.
It's a
suicide's
a terrible goal.
Don't call it a goal. goal.
That's call a it a fucking terrible goal.
A mental crisis.
Before I graduate college, which means a lot of life's milestones will be very upsetting for me. Over the past few years, I would continually comfort myself with, I will be dead by the time I turn 30. But now I'm 29 and my birthday is in June.
Nice.
I've tried hard in treatment to get myself to a place where suicidal ideation isn't ruining and running my life. But I haven't been successful. I just wish I could really explain to people why I'm doing this and why it is best for me. But trying to reason with others just sends me back to the hospital. Why you're doing what? Why you're planning your suicide?
Right. Okay. Because that's not best for you.
So many innocent people die every day, but why can't the people who want to die be taken instead? Well, because that would be too easy, my friend.
Yeah. We're here. Earth is a school, P.S. It's not supposed to be... ponies and rainbows.
Yeah, it's whatever lesson you're meant to learn.
And
yeah,
many of us are failing.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
Drama. Aww. Fucking drama queen over here. Fucking drama queen. Literally, I'm not gonna say Air Mike's personal business, but he's currently
talk about it,
in a deep depression about something that hasn't even been proven true yet. Okay. This is what we're working with as women.
As women.
I don't really know why I'm writing this email. It's really hard for me to talk to my friends and family about this, so I guess that's why I'm emailing you. As role models and neutral parties, we're not neutral. We disagree with you.
Yes. Yeah, I don't think it's a good idea to kill yourself.
All of us. Yep.
And Chad ain't gonna argue with that.
Yeah, I've just been thinking a lot about my birthday in June and how I hope to be dead by then.
Yeah,
it's also like a very passive wishing. You know right. what I'm saying? Like, it's just like, cut the shit. But I get very sad because I do not want to ruin anyone's life. And I know it would destroy my mom and my best friend, who has already lost a sibling to suicide. I know other people would be sad, but they would get over it and move on eventually, right?
No. Oh my gosh. I have a lot to say to you.
I believe if people could understand the pain I feel, they would be open to the thought of me taking my life.
No, nobody.
Baby girl. I'm laughing because no one is ever going to be like, yeah, that's a good idea.
Correct.
People would panic and be like, well, what do we need to do to stop this?
Yeah. I mean, also, if they were okay with it, they would have to go to court, because that's like a new thing where, like, if you okay someone's suicide, you have to go to court.
Oh, geez.
I have been experiencing suicidal ideation for about 20 years, and that's enough. You both have been my guides for the past 5 to 6 years, at least. I forget when I actually started listening, and you've gotten me through some tough times. Thank you for everything. Sincerely, a loyal Philadelphia fucker.
All right.
Well, I mean, first thing I would do if I was having suicidal ideation is leave Philadelphia.
Yeah, that might be a good idea, honestly. Get the hell out of Philly.
That's step one.
Right. Because why not try to help yourself, right? I almost wonder, though, this kind of seems like an OCD looper. I don't know, like that. It's like that image of the guy falling from the tower, which is an extremely haunting image.
Traumatic as hell.
I saw it when I was in eighth grade when 9/11 happened, and I didn't see that stuff right away because the internet wasn't as like prevalent, but I saw it in high school and it fucked me up. But is it possible to get like stuck on that and obsessed? Because it's basically you have a record spinning in your head right now.
Yeah, but it's not like that. It's not like OCD isn't depression.
Okay.
It's anxiety.
It just seems like she has anxiety different. About like, I'm going to be dead by this time. I'm going to be dead by this time. I'm going to be dead by this time. Like, that seems...
Right. Well, this to me, honestly, I'm going to be pretty harsh with you because nothing else has worked. So, I mean, this seems like you're obsessed with, like...
Victimizing?
You're obsessed with yourself and your own demise and, like, how sad everyone else will be. Give life a shot. It seems like you haven't done that.
Yeah.
That's what you haven't fucking done. And since you're writing to us, you obviously have some level of respect for us, or just, you know, we get you through the day. So, you're obviously familiar with my brand of advice. And I'm not going to sit here and be like, oh, live for your family, live for your best friend.
Well, that's
friend.
Not going to work. It's all bullshit.
You've put in this much fucking work. And
you're a young woman.
And to continuously, it's like you're continuously setting this calendar date for yourself. But then you're like pushing back the calendar date. So that, to me, that says you don't actually want to kill yourself. You just aren't getting the answer that you want. Life isn't turning out the way you want it to. Well, it's never going to turn out the way you want it to if you keep wishing for death, because you're this email to me, you're passively living your life. Mm-hmm. And how can a life passively lived be enjoyable? Answer, it cannot be.
Yeah.
So
turn right around, baby.
What you owe it to, don't worry about anyone else in your life. You owe it to yourself to give life an active shot, okay? Mm-hmm. Seriously, cut the bullshit, cut the
fucking sitting in your house thinking about when you're fucking gonna die or when you're gonna do it.
Yeah, just stop.
Cancel
with that
your
shit.
Fucking birthday. All these stop. Like all these dates that you've set up for yourself. It's fucking stop. Nonsense. And you know you like you're smarter than this. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know the deeper effects of this image you saw when you were 9. I don't know if you've discussed that with a therapist, but like I saw that same image when I was a little bit older than you. I think 16, I think, when 9/11 happened. So I saw that same image. And I think it's like a real slap in the face, honestly, to anyone who died in 9/11. And I love a 9/11 joke. You wish that was you. You know, can you imagine someone fucking hearing that you wish that was you?
Would you say that to Pete Davidson?
Yeah.
No, you wouldn't. You just get down on your knees and suck his big old wang, huh?
Pete Davidson would probably be like, me too. Like, you know?
Yeah. Corinne, you're right. That guy didn't do it because he was like, all right, the day's here, I'm gonna jump
out
the window.
Yeah, he had no other choice. He was either burn alive or jump out the window.
You know what that man
but
did?
But it was really sad and tragic and awful.
He didn't have a choice.
Well, actually, he did have a choice. He had a choice
and
he
made the empowered one.
He had a choice to passively die as you continuously wish to do.
I love this theme.
And he took control and he said, I'm gonna die
on
either way.
Today, no matter what.
I'm gonna die on my own terms, okay? So this is not, and this is not saying like die on your own terms. This is saying like don't fucking involve this guy who literally had to die. He had the choice between death and death. You have the choice between life and death.
Yes.
And again, I don't agree with like even though your whole fucking family will be extremely traumatized if you do that. As you know, comedians, we deal with suicide a lot. It's extremely traumatizing. Death, not by choice, is extremely traumatizing. It's been, you know, 8 months since my dad died, and he was an older man, and I still cry every single fucking day. It's not about other people. It's about you. Like you've already gone through this 20 years, 29 years of your fucking life. You said 20 were filled with suicidal ideation. Okay, so let's tap back into those first 9 that fucking weren't. What happened in your childhood that you can go back to, that you can re-understand? Have you looked into, like, have you done the fucking work to be alive? Being alive
Clearly
is a
not.
Fucking job. Okay, mm-hmm. So show up for work for yourself, not even for everyone else, just show up for work. Like, I don't know how you thought we were going to respond to this email, but like, I'm not going to handle you with kid gloves. Give yourself a fucking decent shot at life. Seriously. And stop telling yourself the same fucking sob story, because it's not cute. Really.
Yeah. And as somebody with a parent who's threatened suicide since I was fucking born. You're making your family's life worse by doing what you're doing, okay? If you actually want to positively affect yourself and the people around you, don't fucking talk about how you want to die all the time and live your goddamn life, okay? I am scarred forever from a family member threatening to take her own life and just constantly talking about it. It's so painful. So the pain that your family is experiencing is probably a lot deeper than you can ever imagine. But a way to rectify this, because there is a way to rectify this, is to figure out how to get to a place where you like yourself and you start living your life. Because then that will dissolve the pain that has probably been caused from throwing around your fucking suicide and dangling it in front of people for your whole life. I think it's extremely unfair. So you got to fucking stop that. And 2 other woo-woo suggestions that you can take me up on or not. When I first moved into my new apartment, I, for whatever reason, I just was like obsessed with Medium videos. Laura Lynn Jackson, Matt Frazier, John Edwards, Teresa Caputo, all these fucking mediums. And I've probably consumed hundreds of hours of these videos of them giving readings. Every single time there's a suicide, the person regrets it. Every single time. They've never not regretted it. It doesn't matter if they were in such unbearable pain every second of their day. The second they kill themselves and they're on the other side, they immediately regret it because they're forced to have to watch their loved ones grieve. Such a traumatizing loss. So please know that. And then also look into past life stuff, because that's the only other, unless it's something like Corinne said from your childhood, it might be, but also I've just thrown it out there. Can't hurt. Read Many Lives, Many Masters in order to learn about the subject. It's a very accredited book by a very reputable doctor from Harvard. I would just look into that. Don't give up. Stop. And stop with this bullshit.
Also,
you got this.
I mean, beyond the woo-woo stuff, look into antidepressants. I know that we've kind of talked about this. I mean,
you're on a bunch of pills, and honestly, that might not be... It might be helping. It might not. You said you're on how many drugs? 15?
11 pills a 11? Day.
Yeah.
All right. Well, actually.
So, I mean, your I body chemistry back. Is taking a hit right now because of the medication. And it could be for the better. But just, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, did you tell a professional that you're feeling this way? I'm guessing you did. But if you did, I mean, you didn't. I it feels like. There, you need to go different routes because yeah. It seems like you're kind of just like on this carousel of the same thing. Even like that, the fact, like, listen, it's lovely that you listen to Guys We Fucked all the time, but you don't need to listen to every episode four times. Like you're just kind of like putting yourself in this continual.
You're not giving yourself new experiences and allowing exactly. yourself to listen to new thoughts, right?
And the sentence that really sticks out for me is, I believe if people could understand the pain I feel, they would be open to the thought of me taking my life.
No,
I mean, you are in a romance with your own fucking depression and despair. Okay. And I see so many people doing that right now. It's kind of like almost like a trending thing, especially on the internet, like where we're all in this competition for who's the most damaged and destroyed. And we're doing the same thing. Like, get out of that cycle. Okay.
Yeah, because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. When you're this depressed, your mind's basically telling you that you're pathetic and you're a mess. But that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because what ends up happening is you believe those thoughts, which are not true, because your mind is not you, and then you act pathetic. That's how it goes. So you can pull yourself out of this cycle. You just have to get jostled out of it, and hopefully you hear this and that does the trick.
Yeah, you have to remove yourself. Maybe it's like remove yourself from your surroundings. Like, there are so many variables that contribute to our happiness. And obviously, you have something deeper going on that is actually like a clinical depression, psychological, you know, issues. But we live in a time of modern medicine and a lot of options, especially if you're living in a major city, because you definitely have more access no matter what your financial status is.
I sometimes fantasize about... when I'm really depressed, what it would be like to like fake my own death. I'm not actually gonna do this, but like fake your own death and then like live a new life. And you think of like, oh my God, you could do anything. You could start over at fucking 29 years old and move to another country and do, obviously, you know, this is all fantasy, but it kind of makes you realize, oh, there's more possibility out there than maybe I've been assuming that there is.
Right. And I mean, I gotta be honest, there's a reason why you haven't killed yourself, you know? And like, that's because you don't want to. I truly believe that.
Yeah.
You wouldn't go on for fucking 20 years with the same, that's like someone saying like, you know, I'm going to start a company for 20 years. Like, they're never starting that fucking company.
Right.
You know? You know
what
I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm going to go to the gym eventually. Yeah. And they never do.
And I also think something that would helpful, and this is something I've definitely recommended to several of my depressed colleagues that was helpful, go volunteer for a place where people
that's a great idea.
Are doing worse than you. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. And also, I know,
don't tell them that, but that's where you go. Because you really just got to get your head out of your own ass. And I know you're depressed, and I'm not taking that away from you, but it's become your whole fucking identity.
Yeah.
And you need a new, and
you need to put that on a shelf, baby.
Yeah. And obviously, like, you're not happy with you. So, but you have control to change who you are, how you're perceived in the world, how, you know, how you experience the world. You have control over all this. And stop making excuses that you don't. And I think in the back of your head, you knew this was the kind of advice that we were going to give you.
Yeah, you definitely did. If you've listened to us each episode three or four times, yeah, you know what we're going to say. Oh, man.
Feel free to check in. But I swear to fucking God, if I see an obituary, I'm going to be fucking pissed.
Yeah, please don't do anything.
Yeah. It's hard. It is hard. Like when you're in this like swamp of self-pity, oh, boy. It's like the only thing that really gets you out of it is a change of scenery or somebody going, get snapped the fuck out of it, you dumb bitch.
Yeah.
You know? So I hope that helps. Come see us live. I'm going to be in London. That's in the UK. On May 12th at the Leicester Square Theatre, headlining for one show only. Tickets are pretty much sold out, so get them if they're available. But ChristinaHutchinson.com is where the link is. And Dublin, Ireland, I will be at the Sugarland Club May 13th with Von DiCarlo. And as always, you can listen to episodes of my solo podcast called The Voices in Our Heads, available on Patreon.com/ChristinaHutchinson. And I have at least two group therapy in quotes, Chad, sessions a month for anybody who's a member. And they're very, very helpful. It's how I was introduced to ketamine therapy and a bunch of other really exciting resources. So come join us.
And with Out of Country, the comedy news show hosted by myself and Shane Smith, is out every Saturday on YouTube and wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe to the Without a Country YouTube channel. Follow us on Instagram. It's a super fun show. We chat a little bit about us, but we chat mostly about the news, and it just makes the news like a lot more digestible because we make dick jokes throughout it. Yeah. Again, that's Without a Country. And make sure to rate and review Guys We Fucked on Apple Podcasts. Again, you guys have been doing such a wonderful job with that. Tell us why you like the show. What has kept you listening to the show all these years? Maybe you're a new listener. How'd you find it? Anything like that is super helpful to us.
Yeah, we read them and they're really nice.
Yeah, we work for ourselves. So, yeah, you know, we're the ones fucking reading them. And again, make sure to go to youtube.com/guyswefucked without the U and fucked to check out all the free content that'll apparently stop you from killing yourself.
I hope so.
We have the Dumb Bitch Woo Hour,
ooh,
which is kind of like avant-garde and fun and wacky. We have old episodes of Did That Help? We have clips from our stand-up special. We have the full stand-up special. We have so much content there. And then, of course, make sure to follow us on TikTok at Guys We Fucked without the U and fucked for all the incredible clips from our show.
Yeah.
Shout out to Patty Clips. He does a great
Patty
job with
Clips.
Those.
Yeah.
And shout out to Colt, who did an amazing job clipping up our special. And
yeah, soon make sure you're subscribed to our YouTube channel because full episodes of Guys We Fucked will soon be available.
Yeah, we're just working on them to make them nice, and you know, we have a team, but it's not that big. Yeah, so. Mm-hmm.
Just take time.
It takes a while to do good work.
It takes a while, but anyway, how you doing?
I'm good. I built a trampoline yesterday for my nephew.
Oh, you built? Oh,
yeah.
Built it?
My brother bought
a big one,
big ass one.
I'm so jealous.
It was so fun.
Suburban
then
living.
Then he had to go to the ER because he dislocated his elbow. I'm like,
oh no!
Wow, we were so close.
Wait, your brother?
No, my nephew.
Oh,
yeah.
He dislocated his arm the day they built the trampoline.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so. I
trampolines are so dangerous.
I know. This one had a net. It had a net. I installed it.
So then, how did he do it?
He fell. Like, I think he tried to catch himself in a weird way, and so his weight was oddly distributed. I don't know. He's so flimsy. He's 8. Or he's 7, right?
Yeah.
7. He just had a 7th birthday. He's so tiny. And the kid has so much anxiety, man. Oh my God. I've tried to talk to him. He's afraid to go to bed at night. And I was trying to have like a heart to heart with him and say, you know, I had him name objects in the room because he was like, a man's going to come in my room and get me. And I'm like, okay, well, so that's all in your head. Like, it's your mind. Like, nothing can actually hurt you. The terror and the fear is in your mind.
Right.
So when you feel it, I was trying to teach him to deep breathe because he actually meditates. And I was so proud of him. I'm like, God damn, that's amazing. But yeah, it was so cute. He was like, I don't want to calm down. And I'm like, well, that's a different problem, Brantley. I got to go to bed. But yeah, it was nice to spend the weekend with him.
Maybe he's right though, because I told my therapist right before my dad got sick that I felt like something really bad was going to happen. And
you're
she
right.
said that was in my mind. And then I honestly,
bad happened.
As upset I was about my dad, I was like, I kind of did enjoy being right. I was like,
well, because you never think that. You're not like a doomsdayer.
Kirsten, I fucking nailed it, actually. Yeah.
Is she back from leave?
She actually just emailed me yesterday.
Oh, nice. Nice.
But, you know, I didn't respond to her yet. I don't want her to think I was
too thirsty
for
yeah.
therapy. So. Honestly, it's funny because I've been just as the same, if not better, without therapy.
Yeah. I stopped my talk therapy because I was like, too much.
There was just, I mean, how long? I mean, my dad's dead. How many times can we think about it?
He's
not coming back.
Yeah.
And at what point are you just reopening a wound?
I know.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, it's also like,
answer to that.
It's not like I'm not thinking about it. It's not like I'm repressing about it. I think of it literally 23. I would say how many?
When you're sleeping.
19 hours a day?
A little less because I'm sleeping. So like 15 hours a day I'm thinking about it. You know, that's enough. I think that's enough time to put into it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, my best therapist throughout this whole process has been television. I feel I know now why
Rory
I
Gilmore.
Loved. I'm long finished with that. I know now why I like loved Andy Warhol so much because he said, you know, I'm gonna misquote him, but it was basically like
he had a quote where he was like, I can't believe people still have like relationships after the TV was invented. Like, I don't know how people are keeping relationships
wow,
going.
Wow, he said that before he died too.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah.
Obviously he said that before he died, but like when TV wasn't even as pervasive as it is.
Well, I think, you know, TV kind of came like, cause you know, cause he was
storytelling
like,
is so.
TV came out while he was, you know, alive. So yeah. He got to experience life, you know, or with, like, what year was he born? In the...
Oh, like, I just saw an exhibit.
TV
with him.
Came out in the 1950s.
He was probably born in the 40s.
I can't remember. I used to know all these facts.
It is so therapeutic to watch.
Oh,
a cast
he was
of
born
characters.
In 1928. Yeah, so
oh,
he's
shit.
Experienced yeah. a lot of life without TV.
Oh,
and then you know to have TV introduced, and he was like, I don't know how people continue to have like serious like interpersonal relationships after TV
that's
was
how I feel
invented.
About, that's how I feel about phones.
It's so yeah. fucking
but that's, yeah.
good. Like I
but
love.
That's good. That's good therapy. That's
I
good,
had
helpful
such
therapy.
A satisfying. Factory weekend like I had like the
oh,
best
good.
Weekend of my life because I had such minimal contact with other fucking people.
That's great. Wow.
Yesterday the only person I talked to was a Dunkin' Donuts employee. One of the best days I've had in
wow.
in months.
Wow.
And I worked all day. I worked literally like all day. I cleaned my whole apartment. I mean it's still really bad but
oh,
I cleaned
well,
my apartment
nice,
and I like worked on our TV show. Mm. I did so much fucking shit.
Yay. And you didn't talk to anybody and it was nice.
Didn't talk to, I mean, I could text it a couple people, but other than that.
Right. But it was on your terms.
I mean, incredible. Well, I've been doing this new thing where I put my phone on Do Not Disturb for like all day Sunday.
Yeah. Because it's your whole,
it's my only day off.
You have to have at least one day. My God.
Yes. Was Michael raising his hand?
No,
yeah. It's
no,
like
no.
he was wanting to say
I was
something.
I'm just moving around.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I thought you. Someone commented that they think it's hot when we cut you off from speaking. So.
Oh,
that's a kink.
Yeah,
I love that.
Be...
Oh my God, can I practice being mean to you?
Yeah.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Shut up. Anyway,
are you gonna
is someone talking?
Are you gonna be like a pig?
Oh,
person.
Oh, right. No, I just want to see what it feels like out loud to be mean to somebody. I don't really know how to do it yet, but I'll figure it out.
You want to practice it? I can start trying to say something, and then you can cut me off.
And don't talk.
Okay.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that's fun. I'm glad you had a nice relaxing weekend.
Thank you.
Filled with no people.
Thank you.
That's beautiful. Somebody else who's also beautiful is our guest, Inside and Out. We're so excited to have her on. She is a feminist writer, editor, television director, and producer. She's the co-founder of Bust Magazine, an essential feminist publication. And her book, Getting Over Max Cooper, is out now for you to purchase. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show,
Marcel Karp.
Marcel Karp, we're so excited to talk to you about your book, about your life. This is your first time being on the podcast. Your incredible daughter, Ruby, has been on twice now, right? Twice?
I have no recollection.
I think twice.
Sure.
Yeah.
Twice.
I'm pretty sure.
There you go.
And so we're so excited to get to talk to you. I love these opportunities to get to know further people that I already know, but like on a more, I like excuses to ask people like really in-depth questions. And last time I saw you, oh boy, I had just broken up with Steven. I was at a hotel.
Oh, that long ago? Oh, wow.
I was at a hotel and I was crying and I wanted to die. I think we went to-
We went to Grey Dog.
Grey Dog.
Right.
Yes, I remember that.
Went
and I was just like, am I ever going to be okay? Yeah.
And I was like, as an older woman, I can tell you that you're going to be fine. That was the last time we hung out one-on-one. Yeah. But I have seen you.
Yeah.
Because
oh, okay. Yeah. I was going to say, I was like, that was forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I remember. Yeah. I remember that very, very clearly. And I'm like, and I think I was boning, and I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. You're like, he's hot. Go for it. I'm like, okay. And then I think I remember I was like, I got to go back to the hotel because so-and-so is going to come over.
And I was like, just take it easy. Take it for what it's worth. Don't get too hooked into this guy. And, because you still had to work out what was happening with the breakup.
Oh my God. And I still, mm-hmm. that I'm not doing anymore. I'm working out more like parent stuff, but that always has to do with, for me, at least breakups. That's always how it's been. That's always informed my romantic choices or the parents. How is your relationship with your parents?
Well, before I get into it, I just want to thank you guys so much for having me on.
Oh, you're
really
welcome.
My appreciate pleasure. It. You know, I've been listening to you for a really long time. I don't remember when I started, 2014, 15, 16?
That's right around the beginning. Yeah, we started at the end of 2013.
Yeah. And I admire you so much.
Thanks.
And it makes me so happy. Like the nachas, you know, like I get so much nachas.
The what?
So much like Yiddish joy.
Oh, okay.
just from listening to you and watching you thrive. And
thanks.
Adore you too so much.
Thank you.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
I had to say that because I didn't get a chance to say it when I walked in.
Now it feels like we paid you.
Yeah.
<I know>. Cut.
Clip it.
We do ad placement on our own show, but it's just for us.
Yeah.
The parent thing is complicated, you know, because for a long time, you know, your parents are just there in the background. They're annoying. And, you know, whatever your stuff is, you know, I have a lot of stuff with each my father and my mother.
Mm.
And then, you know, one dies and then the one's left. And, you know, you have just the whatever few years. You know, my mother's now 82. So now I'm starting to look at, you know, what do the next 10 years look like for me in terms of her,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of like elder care. I have a brother, but he has a wife and a kid. So he's like, you know, if God forbid something happens to her, it's going to come on me to do the work of taking care of
her. Is that because you live closer to her?
No, she lives in Florida. My brother lives in Bay Ridge. I live in Stuytown. Oh. So like, yeah,
have to force his hand a little bit though.
I was going to say, it always comes down to the daughter taking care of the parent when there's multiple kids and there's like a son and a daughter. Yeah. I've noticed that.
Yeah, it does. And I do.
You know, women are caretakers by nature.
Exactly. Ugh, and she so leans on me more than she leans on him.
Yeah.
Because she knows shit'll get done if she leans on you.
Yeah.
Right. That's the problem with being responsible. Then people, then you get more work. So it's really better to be irresponsible in life. And when next time I do it, I'm going to be more irresponsible. I swear to God.
I before I had a kid, I was, you know, very irresponsible. And mm-hmm. they didn't rely on me for anything. My brother did more of the caregiving.
Oh, okay.
Because my father got sick when I was 30.
Okay.
And so he would take my dad to the hospital and be there. It was never me because I was, you know.
What did your irresponsibility look like?
Not going to the hospital at all.
Oh. That was very direct.
I don't do hospitals type of vibe?
The one time I went to the hospital when the first really big heart attack happened, I walked in and there was my dad and they had him in a dressing gown. And so I saw what he looked like underneath. Mm, and yep. I just went, I'm not coming back. Not coming back.
Yeah, no, that's a hard sight.
It was, and you know, he was crying and it was really hard for me. And at the time, I like my access to those feelings had been so moved away. Like they were in a file in the back of the closet.
You're
in my
protecting
head.
Your own like vulnerability in a way.
Yeah. And so I was just like, not going to.
Why were they filed away?
You know, my dad, when he was alive, was a really generous person, but he was also a violent person.
Oh, so, that's confusing.
Yeah, so.
Generous and violent.
Yeah, oof. So it was complicated. And so when I became an adult and wasn't like in the midst of the temper or the violence, I never went around. Like I never went to their house.
Yeah, because even your energy is very like, you have a, like similar to Corinne, like just very calm. And like, I know that when Corinne has been, like when we've witnessed violence or like violence has been talked about, just very like.
It's a Jewish mother energy, but my son is a dog, I guess. I don't even consider Alfred my son. He's my best friend.
I'm the same with Rocky. Like he talks, and now Rocky,
pug,
Rocky at 13 is so vocal. Like, you know, your dogs are still so young.
Yeah.
But now at 13, he's just like, if I'm sitting on the couch just minding my beeswax, he'll be like, And you're like, okay, come sit next to me. I'll sit next to me, snore, wake up, and go, okay, now what?
Oh my God, that's so funny. My dog groans like my presence is bothering him.
He does get annoyed. Her dog gets annoyed, like straight up annoyed.
He gets very, sometimes I'll be like, well, me and Alfred aren't talking today.
It's wild how much dogs embody the personality of their parent. Yeah. It's crazy, because Kevin's always like, can I come? What are you doing? Are you going to love me? Like, it's very, wow. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
So it was your father violent towards you, or like are we talking physical violence or
hitting you and your mother, or throwing things?
Yeah,
all three of us.
Yeah. And, wow. What was the first? Do you know the first like memory of him being violent towards you?
11 or 12. I called him an asshole.
Okay.
And he was a New York City taxi driver, so people called him asshole all day long.
Sure. Yeah,
and so it was a trigger. But I was 11 or 12, so I didn't have that, you know, awareness of what was happening in his life outside of the home.
Of course, yeah.
And I got slapped.
Yeah, yeah.
My brother got the belt more than me, but I did get the belt. And my mother got hit.
Yeah.
Wow. Because it's weird because it's okay, so like spanking and hitting and stuff, that was so accepted.
Right.
That was so, I got hit and I was like, but you think about it and you're like, that's fucked up. I was a child.
Well, that's my question. Like my question, because it was like I was going to say it was never acceptable to hit your wife, but that's not true because it was in the 50s.
They had a tank top named after it.
You certainly could hit your wife. Well, that's, I feel like that's more like cops, but like, you could, I mean, I believe there's episodes of I Love Lucy where she gets hit, or there's old movies where the wife gets hit and it's completely
so okay.
Or like, you know, when there's like Straight to the Moon, Alice in like the Honeymooners.
Wait, that's what that means?
It means I'm gonna hit you.
Oh, I thought that was romantic. I thought that was romantic.
You thought it was I love you to the moon and back? No, it's like I'm gonna beat the shit out of you because you're annoying me, bitch.
Yeah.
To the moon, Alice means I'm gonna hit you.
Yeah, that was a threat of violence.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna stop saying that to people.
And there's a generation that laughed at it.
I didn't get that part.
Yeah. No, violence against the wife was very accepted. So I mean, but you're young enough that violence towards the wife wasn't accepted at that point anymore.
It was the 70s, right?
So that was 70s,
no, right?
You know,
it was okay.
You know, my mother, when an incident would happen, my mother would take the kids, me and my brother, and go to my aunt's house,
right,
and just like recover.
Did she talk to you about it?
No, because in the years that he's passed, you know, there's more of like, he was a good man. You know, it's this kind of like,
everyone's a hero after death.
Yeah. And you know, I always feel conflicted talking about it, but this is my story.
That's your experience.
When I was 17, two terrible things happened. My brother, never a good student, got like all D's and F's. And I was like the good student, the one with the A's. And so when he got the report card, my father took the belt to him. And so he was covered in belt welds from the back of his neck to the bottom of his ankles, arms. Couldn't wear shorts the rest of the summer.
That's not what's going to get him to do well in school.
He just wasn't a person who took to school, and that was never.
Right,
so,
right.
And my dad was just like, he didn't understand where, and again, like I'm like looking at it through this lens of, he didn't understand where this failure came from, because he did everything to help my brother
who
had a speech impediment and was like, all these other things. And then I was going to sleepaway camp like for the first time as a counselor, and he was very like, my dad was very agitated about it because it was the first time I'd be away from the house.
I
was
so he didn't understand his emotions,
and he like pushed me into in the bathroom, you know where the towel rack is, he pushed me into that, and my dog at the time just like went for his ankles, and I think my dad caught himself and then retreated to his room and cried, because when the violence would happen, he would, in the aftermath, would be ashamed and go to his room and cry.
Mm. That was a man who had no tools to deal with his emotions, and I imagine the version of masculinity that was pushed upon him was not good.
Again, you know, he spent the first, you know, part of his childhood in a POW camp from the war. And,
that'll do it.
He's got two older brothers, or actually he had three, one died. So, you know, rough housing was normal and for them. And then when he had the wife and he was a taxi driver and he had all this other frustration, this was the conduit was like the three people he loved the most in the world and would die for and all this other stuff. So this again is like through the lens of a woman who's now 58 and who's raised a kid and who's like been in the world. But, you know, it took me a really long time to get there. To like understand who this man was in the context of where he was.
Did you ever ask him about himself, like about his stories, about his past?
I did, but we never really addressed the violence because the one time, like he had had a heart attack and then he had a depression. And when the depression happened, he was like 52, 53. He had to go to... like a home, like a rehab center where they were dealing with depression and also like getting him to be able to walk again. And, you know, that was so hard for him that, you know, he did, he had this thing with my brother where he apologized to my brother for ruining his summer, you know, and then the two of them are crying and all this stuff. And I just went, I have my forgiveness. Like, I'm good. Like, I'm not going to push this man any further. He's his life is was so much harder than mine. And I, even if I had a harder life, I probably wouldn't have done that. But, you know, part of it's like I'm not in recovery, but it's part of my process of like going, OK, this is the man I who is the first man I loved. And this is my experience in his home. So it was a lot of violence. So so when he was in the hospital for the first time and I just was like, I'm good.
I'm good. That makes sense.
I'm good. I don't have to do this.
And is that, did you see ways that that leaked into your dating life early on?
I never, like when I was younger, the first thing I'd be like, do you have a temper? And they'd be like.
Oh, you would just straight up ask them.
Do you have a bad temper? And like, what does it take to make you angry? And so I dated very gentle men for a very long time. And guys that I fucked, it didn't matter. But guys that I, it didn't matter.
Yeah,
but guys but that I dated were very gentle. Like there'd be no question that like I'd get slapped or anything like that.
Right.
That was always in the back of my head.
So you never experienced violence from a partner?
Nice.
That's great. So you were really like, you were leading the charge for yourself in that way.
Like, I was able to like go, okay, that won't work for me, like, you know, saying the wrong thing and then getting yelled at, that's not gonna work for me.
But I feel like that's very good though, because most times like you it's like you rectify the problem before there was one, because I think it's much more common for people who had your upbringing to then go and seek out more violent men and just like recreate the pattern. So how, like, did you were you just always self-aware like that?
I was so scared of being hit that I just went, fuck that.
And you never internalized it. That's what I'm picking up though from you. You never go, oh, I deserve, like, what did I do to deserve? Because a lot of times kids will internalize their parents' behavior if they can't explain it or justify it. But you really had the wherewithal to go, this is a separate issue that has nothing to do with me.
Yeah, that's great. And I wasn't in therapy, like, as a teenager, because my parents didn't have the language of therapy in their world,
and it wasn't it wasn't common into like this generation. I mean, like, unless you were like something like really crazy in quotes happened to you, no kid, you know, of your generation went to therapy.
No, it wasn't until I was in my 20s and trying to work my way through bulimia. You know, like that was like, and I'm like, oh, you know, I gotta see somebody because I gotta stop this. This is bad.
Bulimia. I remember when I was reading, I think it was the Saturday Night Live book and Gilda Radner's autobiography, It's Always Something. They talked about bulimia in 1975, from 1975 to 1980 when they were all in the cast. Her Gilda and Jane would just actively go, oh, we're going to order a pizza for writer's night. And then we would go throw it up. And then we would go, you know, and that was just like so it's so fascinating to me how many things were talked about and just very widely accepted. When you were bulimic, did you ever look at it as that? As like, oh, this is a thing that women do to stay thin.
The first time I heard about it, I was went to Camp Hillel, you know, like sleepaway camp, and we were counselors. And there was a girl named Amy, won't say her last name, and she was like, you know, there's a way we can always stay thin. And I was like, tell me this. What is the secret of staying thin? And then showed me how to make myself throw up.
And you're like, okay,
cool. Sure. Cool.
So, and then you would throw up everything you ate or like only some stuff?
Pretty much I would just go through everything on my table, and then just we would
binge
all
and purge.
Go, yeah, we yeah. just it was just like it was a ritual that we did as a group of girls and stuck in a sleepaway camp. And then I went to Israel for a semester to like a women's seminary, thank you, in Jerusalem. And we were living right near, like right across the street from a bread bakery. So like every day, like when I would cut classes, I would go to the bread
bakery. And bread in Israel is so good.
So good. And then I'd be just be like, I would notice something changing, like something tight on my body. And I'd be like, bathroom.
You wow. know?
Yeah, yeah. So, and then like when I came back from Israel, and my mother was aware that I was bulimic because my aunts would tell her, you know, when she goes to the bathroom and she throws everything up, it's really weird. And so my mother was like, this has to stop.
Yeah.
And so I did. I stopped because I was afraid.
Was it hard to stop? I mean, because the feeling of eating a meal and then having it sit in your stomach is the part where you're like, I am full, right? I imagine like mentally to eat a meal, have it be in your stomach, and then have it immediately eject the wrong way back out. That's gotta, like, did you experience mental side effects from bulimia?
No, not that I know of, you know, but I knew, I was so afraid of getting in trouble that I was just like, okay, I'm gonna stop.
Right.
And, you know, like, my knuckles were always pink, and the capillaries on my under my eyes were always burst, and I always look like, you know, at first, you know, maybe my mother thought I was, you know, on heroin or something, but then when the aunts, like, were like, something's
she's
happening.
Bulimic.
That's when I came home from Israel, she was like, stop.
Okay.
And then I relapsed in my 20s, right before I started BUST. I relapsed because I was going through a depression. I was coming out of a breakup. I didn't feel pretty or thin or all the things that were happening. Like
out of control 1990,
91, 92.
Oof.
And I relapsed. And when I relapsed, I went right back into therapy. I went to therapy. Like I found someone who could deal, who was able to talk to women and men with eating disorders. And just I saw this guy for about a year and then I stopped.
Well, what are some of the things that he told you?
He told me that... you know, when I'm in the process of a binge, to like remind myself what's going to happen at the purge, you know, and how horrible it's going to feel, like just to remind myself, like, you know, you're about to go through a 3-step process. So before you start the binge, and before the purge happens, and before like the aftermath of that, think about what's coming and how bad you feel afterwards.
Right.
Because in my 20s, I start to feel bad. Like I started to feel out of control. I started to feel in control. I started to feel like I was sick, like sick. And he helped me. Like he helped me get through all of that.
Nice.
Just like always think about those 3 steps. 1, 2, 3. Shit.
Right. So it's not, you don't have that immediate gratification of the, ooh, I'm going to, like the idea of binging and purging kind of gives you that fake dopamine hit. But then when you go through the process of the end result is not good, then the dopamine hit is null and void.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And then we also worked on, you know, loving your body and accepting it. And you know, that was very, very hard for me because I just... what was it? It was like 91, 92, 93. So like I'm in the era of the supermodels. I'm like, you know, this is the physical ideal. I'm not that. Of course, like I would look in the mirror and just be like, you know, just like pointing at all the things that I didn't like. And
right.
just like trying to figure out how to fix it. And it just took me a while to just realize like, yo, this is cool.
Yeah. Yeah, you like yourself.
Yeah.
I was like, those are very progressive thoughts. And it's interesting that you went to, was it a straight man or a gay man or you didn't know?
Gay man.
Okay, because I was, okay, that's
more helpful.
That checks out because I was like, I can't imagine having that kind of a conversation with a straight man and not being annoyed the whole time. Mm-hmm. Okay, but that checks
like,
out.
Like, I do not want you to give me any feedback, sir.
That checks out.
Yeah.
And then, so when did you have Ruby?
So I had, I got pregnant at 35 and she was born when I was 36. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you technically had a Jerry. Geriatric pregnancy.
Oh my God, I was a high risk pregnancy.
Yeah,
when I was touring the hospitals, I had to sign all this paperwork. Like you're high risk, and you acknowledge that you're high risk, and you're like, and I'm like high risk. I mean,
I'm a healthy 35-year-old. What are you talking about?
What are you talking about?
Yeah,
but yeah. So I had her. She was born in August. I was probably 36 and a half at the time. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that's funny because you have very much like a Gilmore Girls vibe. Like, yeah. You were like a young mom, but I was like, you were just, you were in fact a geriatric mom.
I was a geriatric mom.
That's so funny. So were you ever married to Ruby's father or what happened there?
I was married to the inseminator. That's what we call him.
That's what I call my dad, the inseminator, my biological dad.
I think I was 34 and it was Christmas time and I didn't have a vacation plan. So I said to my best friend, Kendrick, you want to go to Australia for Christmas? It's summer there. And he was like, sure, let's go. And my girlfriend, who used to live in this building, gave me tabs of ecstasy and just go have some fun.
Go have some fun in the outback.
So Kendrick and I went to Australia. We were staying in Bondi with our friends who had an apartment. And on the first day I walked in, I was sitting on the couch and this surfer dude walked into the apartment, ja, ja, ja.
And your legs and just opened. And I went,
what is happening right now?
And, that's so funny.
And he had been hearing about me because I was staying with our mutual friend. I was the lady who did Bust and all this stuff. And so there was an instant lustful connection. And then we all hung out as a group. And then, Kendrick and I went up to Byron Bay and got a little cottage and hung out there for a few days. And one day we were walking in town and there we saw the inseminator walking by and he moved into the cottage with us. Kendrick went to...
Wait, just asked to do it or just...
He just kind of... I mean, this is the man that he is. He just was like...
I'm here now.
And then...
Clinging.
Kendrick...
love bombing or like...
These two are cool. I'm just going to hang out with them. Two are cool. I'm going to hang out with them. And and then Kendrick went to New Zealand to do, to be with the Maoris and just do all this tribal stuff. And I was like, I want to do that. I want to just sit here in this cottage. And I stayed there with the inseminator. We did ecstasy and then that was it.
Wow.
Yeah, that was it.
And then you ended up marrying him.
So then we started dating he was in Australia. I was here. He came.
Yeah, that's a huge time difference. I thought dating interborough is hard.
It was for me, it was a lark. This is hot guy. I'm, all this stuff. And he came to New York and stayed with me for a month. And then I went to Australia and stayed there for a few weeks. And then he decided to move to New York. And he came and lived with me for almost a year, maybe a little bit less. And when he left,
was he paying rent?
No, he did nothing.
Knew it.
And so a lot of our fighting,
did he work?
No, a lot of our fighting was that he wasn't willing to do the under the table jobs that my friends were offering. I got him involved in this basketball night with the men that I hung out with. They did this basketball game at PS41.
Of course, you facilitated his transition. Yeah.
Here's a life for you.
Yeah.
I gently created.
And then every so often a friend would be like, would you like to paint my bathroom? I'll pay you $100. And he would do that. But he wasn't really doing enough. And so we started fighting about money. I realized that he wasn't my person. I knew that he wasn't my person, but I was just how do I get rid of him? And then
were you married at this point?
No, we were just fucking.
Oh, wow.
Just fucking and having a good time.
Wow, yeah.
And then he left. And when he left, I realized I was pregnant.
Mm.
Oh.
Yeah. And so he came back when I was...
That was probably a fun phone call.
Yeah, when I called him to tell him I was pregnant, he was just like, wait, what's happening?
Blimey.
And, what? Blimey.
Did I?
And then we didn't talk for a really long time.
What?
And then, yeah.
Wait. On your terms or on his? Was he just not picking up?
He just was he was overwhelmed. He was 26 and he was overwhelmed.
And you weren't?
I was I'm having this baby with or without you.
Okay, so you knew away, this is my baby. I'm good.
I was I've never been.
Oh, so you were 10 years older though, because he was 26. Okay.
Yeah. So
you've been getting younger guys for a while.
I have always been with younger
guys. It's your vibe.
And we can get into that, but
we will.
I have always been with younger guys, and they've always been really hot until I dated the nerd. But but they've always been super, super hot. And the inseminator was hot, 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 hot. Anyway, so when he finally came out of the wait, she's pregnant phase and she's having this baby, he was like, I want to come back. I want to be a father to this baby. I want to be your husband. I want to be in your life. And I was like, yeah, but you're never going to be able to work here and make, and like at the time I had like a really serious career. I had mm-hmm. Bust had been sold. We were doing it for full time. I was also producing at HBO. So like I had, I
you
was,
were on it.
I was
you were
like,
on fire.
And so I said, okay, baby, baby's due August 30th. You can come August 23rd. You should know that Sonic Youth is playing Hammerstein, so I'm going to be going to that show. and he was like, wait, what? And I'm like, I don't need you before that. And,
yeah.
and I knew really like if he came before that, I would have to be dealing with this.
You'd be annoyed.
Person that, yeah. you know, didn't. Kendrick was my birth partner, like, so wouldn't know.
Oh, so he's your friend, yeah.
You know, so wouldn't know how to help me when the baby was coming out or even help me in the apartment.
It would just be more trouble.
Yeah.
And like, that's the honest truth. And like, I know people get down on us on this podcast sometimes because like, we're always like, men suck. But it's like, well, if you helped,
if they helped,
then we wouldn't
better.
Have stories like this.
Right.
You know, like
yeah.
this should be a learning experience. So instead of like hearing stories like this and being like, well, they just hate men. It's like to hear this story and be like, I don't want to be this fucking guy.
No. And,
okay.
and I
anyway,
knew
back.
The guy that
no,
would
it's important.
Help.
Like, be more helpful, guys, please.
And also, like Kendrick was helping me, you know.
Yeah.
Kendrick was my birth partner.
He went to the classes
he
with
came
you.
To all my classes when the baby was on her way out. He was the voice that I heard going, come on baby, you can do
Aww.
This, you can do this. He was my person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was, and he's been the person that helped me raise her. He spoke at her bat mitzvah.
Aww.
You know, he's coming to graduation for college. Like, he's
oh my god, she's graduating college already. Oh
in
my.
2 weeks.
Oh,
crazy.
My god, I remember when she got accepted. Holy shit.
The whole thing is
time just like happens. That's
yeah.
crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. So I did marry the inseminator because he needed a green card. And like the only way he could stay here was if he had a green card.
Did you grow bitter towards him?
I didn't like him.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I was like.
But you married him to give him a green card so that he could be a part of your daughter's life?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you know, maybe there was like a moment where I'm like, maybe we can make this work.
Sure.
But like after the towers fell,
literally, like 9/11?
9/11.
Okay.
After the towers fell, after 9/11. So what happens is I got kicked out of Bust. I had
kicked out?
I had a calcification in my breast.
Oh.
And then 9/11 happened. So I looked
Jesus.
At the inseminator and I went, we're going to Australia. We're going to go stay with whoever's going to let us stay at their house. And we're going to stay there for a long time.
Yeah.
And so we went back to Australia. We stayed in Canberra with his mother's house. And then we.
How was his mom?
She really loves her sons.
Copy that. So, I know exactly what you mean.
And so so we got an apartment and then I bought a house and we stayed there for a while. And I realized while we were there, he's never going to be able to take care of this family. And I don't want that.
Yeah, he's never going to step up.
You can tell
if he's going to be able to step up or not. Yeah,
yeah, he's going to be added weight.
So we came back to New York and we knew that we were now going to be separating. And so we still maybe took like 6 months before I found another apartment. I didn't want to stay in the apartment we were in because I knew he would never leave. So I got an apartment on the Upper West Side. He moved in with his friend, the model. He had a friend who's a model who was part of the basketball crew. And then he lasted maybe a year and then he went back to Australia.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Because you're like, we need to clean up shop here.
Yeah.
You're not. You're bringing down the team.
So how long were you officially married for?
Like 2 years.
Okay. And you got a. Did you get a divorce?
It took a while to get a divorce, and it was like, it took a while before.
Divorces always take a long time
because it costs so much money. And like I had to get a lawyer and all this stuff.
Oh, yeah,
so like
yeah.
I kind of dragged my feet on it until I got into a real relationship with a man who was like, I want to marry you. And I'm like, oh, I'm still married. So
yeah.
I got to get rid of this. Like I got to take care of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the, and you know, the last time I've spoken to him was when Ruby was in eighth grade and he came for a visit. And I think the last time she spoke to him was probably 10th grade.
Okay, just kind of peacefully going your own ways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I still talk to his mother. I still talk to his father. His brothers and I are in touch. Like, I,
Wow, interesting. That's so you like them? Like, you like his family?
They're her family. So,
right.
You know, when she was in ninth grade, the father and the step, I'm sorry, her grandfather and his wife came to visit. And then when she was bat mitzvahed, her grandmother and her partner came. So like, you know, she's seen them over the years.
Yeah.
The family.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm also curious about, we gloss over this very bust.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so tell everybody what bust is and how you got to be involved in it. And then I'm curious about this kicking out
thing.
Oh,
yeah. That thing was... anyway, so 1990, maybe even little earlier, I was working at Nickelodeon as like...
You can't do that on television years, right?
Yeah. Oh, and man. I was really desperate to be a promo producer because that was the department where all the cool kids were. Uh-huh. And like the people who created Pete and Pete and those people, like I wanted to be over there.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. So I really had to, I got to Nickelodeon as a coordinator in the programming department. And then when there was a spot open in the promo department, I went there. But in that in-between area, I was sharing a cubicle with the woman I would create Bust with. And, you know, she liked me because I listened to The Fall. I liked her because, like, you know, she was, like, already in fully realized as a feminist and would, like, tell me these things. And she lived on St. Mark's across the street from Cafe Chenet.
Damn, so I would see her there. In the late 80s.
Yeah. Like shit. This kind of thing. And like we would, so we got to be friends. And then we started having this conversation about like what was happening with women, the women's music scene in Olympia, and what was happening in pop culture for women in general, like what mainstream magazines were constantly promoting. Like you would look at Cosmo or any of those women's magazines, and it was always like how to be in service to men.
Right.
Five ways to give a good blowjob. Yeah, that kind of thing. And we were like, maybe we could do something. Maybe we could do something better than this. That actually gives us agency and puts us center.
Yeah.
And we started having these conversations, and then they kind of went away. I went to Paris for about 6 months and like lived with a friend there, and I would meet, and I ended up meeting like the people who would be my very best friends for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. Like, and when I came back from Paris, I called her up and I was like, did you ever do anything with that like zine thing we were talking about? She's like, no. And I'm like, I think it's time for us to do something. And she was like, okay, cool. And so we went to, at the time, and we already had Bust as a title. Like we wanted something title. That was like a double entendre, that was active, that, you know, felt feminist. And also was like body part, like everything about it was amazing to us. Like we were like, oh my God, we are so smart. and we went to See Here because we really didn't know what DIY publishing was. So See Here was a zine store on East 7th in the East Village that was like
a zine store. Fuck.
It was our church. And so we would go there. Like, I don't know, I think we spent almost every day for a month going there and talking to the proprietor, Ted, I can't remember his last name, and ask him all these questions. And he pointed us into the direction of this zine called Fact Sheet 5, which was like the Bible. It was like the encyclopedia of zines. So any kind of zine you wanted to see was in this thing.
Oh, how cool.
And then I reached out to the guy who published it, Seth Friedman. So we did a lot of like research on how to do a zine. And then like I had already left Nickelodeon at this time. So this is already now 1993. It took us a long time. But
yeah.
Like,
you had to learn an industry essentially.
And you don't have the internet to help you.
Right.
Yeah.
You have to go site to a zine store and look up books. Like.
And so she was working at Nickelodeon. We reached out to some of the women that we liked in our lives and we were like, we have this kind of idea to do a zine. What? Yeah, a zine. It's a DI. It's a do-it-yourself magazine. And we have this idea and we'd like for you to write about a day in your life. And all of our friends were like, yeah, I'm going to do it. Do I have to use my name? No, you could use a pseudonym. Mm-hmm. Actually, we're using pseudonyms. What are yours? Mine is Betty Boop, which my mother thought was so funny because she loved Betty Boop. And I was like, yeah, she was like, oh, Betty Boop, ha ha ha, Betty Boop.
that was for you, Ma.
That's
sweet.
And then we found an art, like somebody who knew how to do Photoshop because we didn't know how to do it. And then we kind of like put the zine together of all these articles of women writing about a day in their life. And then we did our manifesto. Like we wrote, you know, why we exist and what we're doing and what we plan to do, which is like be a place for women, about women, by women. So like it would be submission based. Like, so all the stories wasn't going to just be me and the other one writing about ourselves. It was always going to be, you and you and you writing about you. The other part of DIY publishing is that we had to figure out where to be distributed. And so part of what Factsheet 5 did was give you like a resource list of all the places that carried zines. And so at the time it was Tower Records and it was mom and pop shops. And yeah. It was like these larger distribution companies that aren't around anymore, like Big Top and all this kind of stuff. And I reached out to all those people. I did my pitch and, you know, this one would take a few and that one would take a few. And while I was doing the sales, me and the other co-founder would go to Nickelodeon After Hours and Xerox and staple our zine.
Nice.
Because by then the art director had laid it all out. So like, it was, we were...
She had to assemble it.
Juggling. We got a P.O. box where we would have submissions. We got an AOL address. I think the AOL address was bust@AOL.com.
Incredible.
I mean, it was just like...
Yeah,
and, you
awesome.
Know, like when I look at it, we didn't know that we were filling a white space. Like we didn't know that we were filling a space that would be intersectional. We didn't know that... we would be doing it, that they would be doing it for 25 or 30 years. Like we were just like, we're going to do this zine and we're going to like, we're going to say, fuck you to these mainstream women's magazines. And we're going to like center us and our pleasure and our anger, you know, because it also at the time, 1993, it's on the heels of the Rodney King riots. Mm. It's on the heels of the pro-choice rally. It's on the heels of the gay march. Like it's on the heels of all this like civil unrest in this country. And what's his face? Clinton was in charge. Mm-hmm. So a lot was happening so that, you know, we became third wave. And it coincided, much like historically coincided with civil unrest and like revolution in the black community, kind of like what happened during the second wave, mm-hmm. and kind of what happened the first time around with the suffragists and abolitionists. So like it was almost like we were repeating history.
Yeah.
And you know what we should have done is really looked at that, because like. Not only were we repeating history from a feminist landscape, but interpersonally, we were repeating history. So like if you look at some of these movies about like Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan and all these other things, like how fractured those relationships became, that's kind of what happened with us. Like as we started to, okay, the first scene came out and then we'll do a second one, then we'll do a third one, then we'll do a fourth one. By time... we were really like, oh my God, this is what we're going to be doing like four times a year. We were in a rhythm.
Yeah.
And then it became our life. And then once it became our life, like stuff started to like sprinkle in.
Like
that
what?
Was like, you know, petty jealousies. Like I would go out every night to see bands and, you know, the music industry basically funded Bust, like with advertising and stuff. And so like I'd see, you know, this publicist or that band or that manager. And then the other co-founder would be out like some days later and go, oh, you do Bust? Do you know Marcel? She's amazing. And mm-hmm. then the co-founder would be like, wait, what are you talking about? Is she telling you that she's the founder of Bust? I'm the co-founder.
Gosh.
So it became like this craziness of not being able to find a way where there was room for all of us.
Do you think part of it has to do with tasting success?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and being afraid it was going to go away.
Yeah.
And I feel like, because I was going to say all those things that you're describing seem to come from a place of fear, like the your co-founder being like, well, I was doing it too. Like there's a fear underlying there of what, who knows? It could be one of a million things.
Yeah, and also not to put everything on her, you know, maybe like, I was going out every night and maybe I was doing stuff that was annoying to her.
Right.
You know, but I showed up.
You just weren't talking about it.
We weren't talking about it. And then we did go to therapy.
The two of you.
With the third, with the art director, because then she became a partner. And then it became two against one almost always.
Oh.
And then it didn't work.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't work.
Sucks.
So by the time I had the baby, I was the first person in the company, because at that point we were acquired by a larger company, and I had a baby. I was the first woman to go on maternity leave, so like they didn't even know what to do with that. And I came, yeah, it was run.
They didn't
men.
Even know what to do. Were acquired, you had to go on maternity. So what was that conversation like?
It was horrible. Like it was horrible. Like so, I knew that. Like we now had offices and we all had our own computers, and the co-founder sat behind me so she could see what I was doing all day long. And then sometimes I'd be looking at baby shit, because by the time when I came back after having a baby, fucking around sometimes.
Well, that's what you do during the day. Like you, that, and then that takes you back to your work.
Like, and she would be like, what are you doing?
Controlling.
And you'd be like, you know what? Fuck you.
Yeah.
And that's how the cubicle was invented. So you can't see other people's shit.
Like, fuck you. Like, fuck you.
Right.
You know, because like, fuck you. And so the two of them were already probably having a conversation long before the conversation ever really happened. Mm. And, you know, we went to like coffee and they were like, go. And I was like, okay. And I'm giving you such an abridged version.
Right, of course, yeah. Well, how long? Okay, so just what's the timeline? Because like, so you're having Ruby when you're like 36 and a half, and like how old were you when you started Bust?
I started Bust in 1993, so just 29.
Okay.
29? Yeah.
So it had been a while.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, you know, I come back from maternity leave and I'm still in like baby vibes. Like I'm in, you know, my boobs are so swollen and, you know, just like not.
And how long were you on leave for?
Just like 3 months, you know, 3 months. Okay. Yeah. And I was like, you know, before I had the baby, I was the center of my universe. And all of a sudden that center shifted and it became her. And, you know, just to sustain the life, because, you know, when they're just like a baby, they're just like, there's nothing happening. Gotta make sure that they wake up for the feeding.
Yeah.
So I, you know, when I had the conversation with the two, it didn't hurt as much until much later, because I was like, I have a baby.
Yeah, your like, priorities are completely rearranged.
I have a
baby.
I have a career outside of this. Like I can make money. This is not the end of the line for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is always, as a daughter of a taxi driver, that's always like the drive. Like I have to find a way to make money. And drive, haha. So so like they said go, and I went, okay, fine. And then me and the inseminator and the baby went to Hawaii for like 3 weeks.
Did they buy you out though, or
there was no real buying out, because we were owned by another company,
right.
So we sold everything we had. And by the way, like we didn't get a lot of money from that deal.
Oh, okay,
you know? But I was able to still go back to HBO and produce promos and still make a living, a really good living. So like, you know, it wasn't, but when that happened, I turned to the inseminator and said, I need a little vacation. My head is like buzzing. And so we went to Hawaii for like 3 weeks and I rented a house and I just kind of like unwound from 7 years of like toxic energy, from these two women.
Yeah, and I feel like toxic energy from women is much more toxic than toxic energy from men.
Because like when you start a feminist utopia, like you think, you know, and I don't have sisters. So like I thought like these are going to be my best friends forever. Like these are the women who are going to be by my side forever. I really, really believed
it.
And when business started to get in the way of friendship, like it kind of. So
when you really have to do maintenance along the way,
you do.
Like when the second something like there's something, the riff, it's like you got to address it or else it's going to be under the surface and then explode.
Yeah, and that's kind of what happened.
Right.
And also I think, you know, both me and the co-founder, we wanted to continue to be editors, and she really felt like she should be the editor.
Mm.
And I was like, no, I don't think so.
Yeah.
You know, now when I have friends who are in partnerships, in a threesome, I always say, make sure your roles are defined. Like, make sure you each know what the other one, what you're all doing, because like,
otherwise,
if you start a business, someone will always look at someone else and go, I'm doing more work than you, or you're not representing the brand the way you should be. And you know, you just have to really be very clear about it. And, you know, at another time, we might have been clear, or if we'd had mentors or anybody to like just go, okay, you three are, there are two alphas in this relationship, so you two need to figure your shit out.
Yeah.
And we didn't, like, that didn't happen to us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you ever talk to these people again? Or?
I have never spoken to the co-founder. I have not spoken to the co-founder since that conversation.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
They invited me back for some anniversary.
And big of them.
They invited me back for some anniversary. And I said, well, am I going to be on stage or in the audience? And they said, oh, no, in the audience. I went, no, I don't need to be in the audience.
Yeah,
I go backstage at really big concerts. Yeah, like, I don't need to be backstage. I don't need to be in an audience of something I built.
Yeah.
That's
crazy.
Wow.
So, like, if we look up on, like, Wikipedia or whatever, like, are you in the Wikipedia article for Bust?
My understanding is that...
I guess I could just look myself, yeah. But...
I probably am.
I
probably
hope so. Am. There's, I hope so. There's,
they put out a book a few years ago, and one of my friends picked it up and went, you know, you're not in the book at all. And
oh, I'm my like, God, Marcel.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, what are you going to do? You take legal action, which is like a long, strong out heartache.
I also don't care because I haven't been involved in it since 2001.
Right.
I did the first 18.
9/11 happened, and you were like, see ya.
Gotta go.
Yeah. Okay, so good news. You are like, okay, so like in the first like paragraph where it explains it, who created it, you're not there, but then right below where it has all the important parts like who's the editor-in-chief, who's the founder, you are in the list of founders.
Yeah.
There's three.
Good. Thank you.
Which is like the three, I'm guessing.
And also
we won't say their names.
No. Also, like, the it was really me and the other person who found it. We brought in the one who's now called a co-founder. We brought her in at the fourth issue.
That was Spinderella to your salt and pepper.
you can be, you know, you should be a partner because you're doing as much as we are. She was laying out, like, she was designing those books. Like, she was designing them. So, like, it seemed to me very fair
that
she should be a full-fledged partner. And then that made her more invested.
You know,
and she would have to give up her nights to lay out that magazine. Like, she did it willingly as opposed to like.
Right.
Yeah. Have you found yourself since that experience working with women on something like feminist centered, like on any given project?
I've not ever stepped away from women centered projects. Like, I'm now working on a master's in women and gender studies.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Oh, like, that's so
my
exciting.
My cohort. I love my cohort. They are just, oh, I just love them so much. And it's also so nice, like, to be on this side of like feminist scholarship and just like unpacking stuff. And every so often we'll talk about third wave and I'll be like, ooh.
Well, can you explain to us the third wave? Like,
So when we talk about the waves of feminism, mm-hmm. it's when like new leadership shows up or new ideology, not like are men and women of equal value. That's not the question.
It's like new ways of tackling feminism.
Right. So when Betty Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique, you know, the problem, no name, I'm a housewife, I'm a white housewife in the burbs. And, you know, she unravels like this simmering in the 60s and you get the second wave, you know, and then, you know, you have like all this other stuff happening with like Elaine Brown and Angela Davis and Kimberly Crenshaw and Audre Lorde and all these women who are like, wait, this is not a white, like they're.
This is not inclusive.
It's not inclusive.
Women, you have to represent all women.
And so you have this huge conversation and you know, and everybody has, particularly in second wave, the underlying tension was the personal is political, the personal is not political. Like, I don't want to be your housewife. I want to be a working woman. But there's other stuff, like from a Black woman's perspective
or
an Asian woman's perspective. So second wave is kind of really linked into the feminine mystique and the 60s and what was happening in the world at the time. And then not even did you talk about what's happening globally.
Right.
Just only talking about America. Mm-hmm. And then third wave, you know, so you have the 70s and, you know, Gloria is now the face of second wave. She starts Gloria Steinem.
Gloria
so she
Angela,
starts,
yeah.
She starts Ms. Magazine. Mm-hmm. And
well, and her and Angela were like side by side, right?
Yeah. And Angela Davis actually has done a lot of work in like prison reform and stuff like that. You know, so she kind of she moved her lens somewhere else. And you know, she's a professor and like in the early 90s, again, like so much was happening, punk rock, grunge.
Yeah.
And like I said before, Clinton, Rodney King, like all this stuff is happening. And you had this third wave kind of come into play of feminists who are like, I want to wear lipstick and I want to be in charge when I'm fucking you. And like all this other stuff.
I want to
like,
be sexy, whatever that is to me, like, and in charge.
Sex and sexual pleasure became the conversation as opposed to like, don't touch me right now.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like, I want to be in this, you know, with, so I kind of like, once I had the baby and sort of embraced raising her and being a working woman and, you know, being a corporate person, I kind of like took my eyes off the ball a little bit, but I know that in the late aughts, a fourth wave kind of, evolved, and the conversation was really digital, like body shaming, slut shaming, that language. And I don't have like a mastery of that language because I took my eye off the ball. But like now that I'm doing the masters, and every so often, like it'll come up, I'll be like, what, what happened? So to answer your question, like I haven't really left. I sometimes take the eye off the ball. I do also think like my work in raising a daughter and instilling feminist values in her, and then like anytime like one of her little friends would, you know, come around just being like, the future is female.
Right.
Just like that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, this is a 10-minute warning. How do you infuse feminism on your daughter? Because you have a lovely young lady that you've raised.
Thank you very much.
Who really has a good head on her shoulders. And when I think of Ruby, I go, that's a young woman who can handle herself, who can get the resources. Like, I feel like she's very bold in getting her own resources when she needs them. Like, she's really on top of, like, her own needs in this way that I think is so beautiful that I'm so not envious, but, like, I'm really excited to see a younger woman, like, just kind of take her own, the charge of her own life in that way. So what were those conversations that you've had with her like?
I think, thank you very much for saying all that. It really just makes me just, like, another Yiddish term, reclamped. She's an observer. She's like you are, she's a stand-up comic. So like you're constantly looking at the world through a lens of critique and, you know, you're questioning and you're trying to, it's not just chasing the joke, but like it's trying to figure out what the social
angers
comment.
Me. Yeah. What, yeah.
And I think observing me has been that conversation. Like I work my ass off, you know, sometimes I work two jobs and, you know, now I have a full-time job and I'm also doing a master's and I've just come out with a book. Like she's always watching me like not be idle. Like through a lot of my 50s, I couldn't find a job. And so she watched me struggle through like, you know, dealing with ageism and confronting that and trying to, work within a system that doesn't appreciate a woman in her 50s. Like, so I think a lot of what she's learned is from watching and observing. And, you know, always having the conversation of like, if a boy can do the monkey rings, so can a girl. Like when she was expert of the day in kindergarten, like, you know, she came in and talked about feminism.
Yeah.
You know, like,
oh, that's great. Yeah.
Of course she did.
And it was literally like, this is what feminine, if you can do the monkey ring, so can I. If you can knit, so can I. Like, it was just like, we are of equal value.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. Now, speaking of your book,
yes,
Getting Over Max Cooper, can you summarize this for us? This is a fiction book that you wrote and it's out available now for purchase, right?
Officially.
As of this episode airing.
Yeah, right. As of this episode airing.
Right,
yeah, give us a little bit about a little taste of the book and why you wrote it.
So I, as a mom, when I would read stories to my daughter, I didn't see female-centered stories. Like you saw Olivia the Pig when, you know, maybe when she's 3 or 4, but there wasn't a lot. So I would write these little stories and tell them to her. And so by the time she got to be around 10, I was writing longer stories. I wrote this in 2015. I was, at that point, I was like, I'm just going to write books now and she's going to read them. And she didn't, but you know.
And she wrote her own book too.
But I wrote this because, I wanted to be a writer, but, for most of my daughter's childhood, we would go to Fire Island for the summer and I would watch these beautiful sun-kissed teenagers just ride their bikes and just have all this autonomy. And I was just like, I wonder what your lives are like. And yeah. so I started, that's where I got the idea, just watching these teenagers, even before mine was. And then I started writing this book, and it's about a pair of best friends who hang out with this friend group in Fire Island. They're sun-kissed, they're riding their bicycles all day long. They're falling for people. Mm. They're just like having their lives. But, you know, it's also an investigation of the ethics of care. When you're best friends, how do you care for someone who's in crisis? How do you look out for yourself when your friend is in crisis? What are those ethics? Can you walk away from somebody who's in trouble? And so this really kind of explores that. That's a symptomatic reading of it. The overall reading is like, it's euphoria on the beach.
Oh, yeah. Okay. There you go.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And then I want to go back quickly to ageism, because I think that's a big problem. And we don't have enough women over like 40 on this show. And it's not because we don't try. It's just harder to get that age group in, I think. And especially when you have to explain like what Guys We Fucked is. It's a whole thing. But it's definitely something that you see a lot. And mostly I feel like it's because of technology, but like, just because someone doesn't know how to use Instagram doesn't mean that they don't have like a ton of valuable things to bring to the table. So can you kind of go over why you felt you had trouble getting a job in your 50s, what younger women should look out for before pushing older women out of jobs?
Get better with age, and it is such a shame to the way that the society functions towards women aging, because it's quite the opposite of what actually happens, and it's a real disservice.
Well, and it does feel like there is like a war between, you know, quote unquote younger women and older women, and I even feel it in stand-up when I'm doing it. Like women like I would say 50 and over are probably the most difficult people to make laugh, and it's because like they have an unwarranted anger towards young women, and younger women don't respect older women, so it's like just back and forth
and I'm
just like, I'm on your side, don't be mad at me.
it's a combination of this, right?
Yeah.
So like when you're dating, like, or actually, let me backtrack. In an office situation,
right?
If you're not fuckable, you're not taken seriously, which is the craziest.
But when you are fuckable, people just want to fuck you.
Exactly.
So it's like, is that being taken seriously?
It's a double-edged sword. So like, I was sexually harassed at a job for years until I squashed it. But like, that guy would only hit on young women who are attractive, and somehow me in my 50s, I got hit on by him. And it was like, oh, so this is my validation. You think I'm fuckable? That's interesting. Like, leave me alone. But anyway, so there's a couple things. Dating apps, I can't get a date because I'm over 50, not fuckable.
Right, I mean, I didn't know everyone was lying about their age. Like, even in your 30s, like, I mean, being over 35, I should have lied when I went on there, because everyone is lying. So if everyone's lying just to keep neck and neck with people, you have to lie.
Yeah, and you know, and maybe sometimes I would play with my age, but
sure.
But if five is in my age, I'm not gonna get any matches with anybody. I remember when I came over to your apartment, you were showing me the app that you were on at the time. We were looking at all the like famous people on it. That was
Raya.
But that would never happen for me as a woman in my 50s, even though like there were some real legendary rockers on there. But anyway, so ageism is something that happens at a point in a woman's life, also happens to men, but I'm not really concerned about them.
No, they're fine.
Happens in a woman's life, like in a work situation, maybe, where she's no longer of value.
Right.
And it could be that like—
Fuckable value,
fuckable
really,
value.
Is what we're talking about.
It could be like that her face is like not taut. Like, I don't have any Botox, this is what I look like.
Right.
But if my face were taut, I would look like I'm 45, you know? And
right.
So anyway, so when I was like interviewing for jobs, like I would get a call from HR because my resume is impressive, but then they would see what I would look like and go, she could be 45 or she could be 55. She's not 65.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Did they ask you ever?
I was once on a job interview.
Isn't it illegal to ask?
On a job interview where a woman who was 35, who told me she was 35, said to me,
I'm 35.
How would you like, how are you going to feel working alongside my babies? And I was like,
what?
what'd you say? And she was like, well, most of my staff are in their 20s and, you know, clearly you're not. And I was like, oh, I'm not getting this job, am I? You know, like, it, or you're, I was up for another job interview where the woman brought me back like several times and then ended up hiring somebody for the same job, like 4 years out of college, you know, and you start to see this pattern of like who you lose the job to.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
And that's when you start to like, when this is when you start to see ageism really in play. Like,
yeah.
Who you lost the job
to. You're completely missing the value in living life more than everybody else. Like there's so much value in that.
Yeah. There's so much. There's also, I still have so much to offer.
Right.
You know, I'm,
you have more knowledge. Like your knowledge is unique.
Well, because you think an ideal team, I think people of all different ages and all different ethnicities.
Right.
And then everyone has like their area of expertise. Because like, yes, I'm not going to pretend that you don't need someone who knows how to fucking nail a TikTok. Yeah, we even hired someone who taught us TikTok who was 10 years younger than us.
Yeah.
That very being helpful. Said, they don't have any life experiences. And there's the same people writing in dumb bitch emails
they're
to
pussies.
Us.
So it's like, you know, right? Take the go with the bad.
You know, so, you know, okay. So that happens. And then,
and so I think too, like in stand up, you know, as you get older, you get a little harder, you know, so maybe like that's where the energy is coming
right.
from, you know, like,
yeah.
you know, life gets harder as you get older, your body starts to hurt.
Sure.
You know, you as a woman, like when you're in your 20s and 30s, like you get hit on all the time, people woohoo at you, you know, it doesn't happen as much and you start to miss it. Don't really, I miss it. I fought against it. Why am
right,
I missing
right,
it?
Right,
but,
right.
But you know, yours, you... Women start to get erased at some point.
Yeah, I'm not for sure.
I'm not sure what that point is, if it's actually 45 or is it 51. But when I got, when in 51, I found myself unemployed, my friend said to me, you are not going to find another job.
Oh, that's
you
a work, good friend.
You work in a youth market and they're looking for people younger. Mm. And I was like, no, that's not right.
Yeah.
I'm going to find a job.
Yeah,
and I did.
Exactly. You don't accept that, but that's what it takes.
Yeah.
It takes you to not accept that in the face of a friend telling you this. And it's like, okay.
And she told me that because she was in her 50s.
Right.
And
I'm sure she was projecting her own experience, which is, you know, everybody's opinion is them projecting their own experience.
And so that's why I went and got that's why I'm working on a master's, because I would like to have a plan B.
Yeah.
You know, like I would like to teach women's studies, women and gender studies to women and men and anybody else on the college level.
Yeah.
You know,
facilitating these conversations. Yeah. For people.
Oh, and then lastly, I don't know if you're comfortable talking about this. So if not, we can bleep it out. But you're friends with Yoko Ono. Can we talk about this or no?
Who's that?
I'm not friends with her.
Oh, okay.
I'm friends with her children.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sean.
So when...
He's so hot.
Like a doll.
Oh, so he's so handsome.
In the 90s when he was in my social circle. And when it turned out I was pregnant... I bumped into him at Chopsin's, which was like this corner,
The restaurant?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I saw the documentary about Chopsin's. It's so sweet.
So sweet, right? Well, so that used to be like where I went and had lunch or dinner or whatever.
Cool.
And see my friend, and he said, you know, my sister just had a baby. I'd like to hook you up with her, like connect you with her.
Mm-hmm.
So
Sean said that.
Yeah. So he introduced me to his sister. And that
I didn't even know he had a sister.
Because Yoko had a child from the marriage before. For it with John Lennon.
I see. Okay,
yeah,
got it.
So that's how I know them, and we've been in each other's lives.
Because I was a child that Yoko wasn't allowed to see for quite some time, right? Because I became really, really interested in Yoko Ono's story from the C Word podcast by Lena Dunham and Alyssa Bennett, because there is such this negative narrative about Yoko, and you know that she broke up the Beatles. And then when you listen to the story, it's like
she fucking didn't,
being abused in various ways by various people throughout time. And so that's what really like made me want to learn more about her and her story, and it's fascinating, and like kind of like one of the people that history is all wrong about, for sure.
She's such a generous person.
Yeah.
I went up to her farm our kids were really little, and she looked at me and her daughter from across the table, and she went, I'm so happy to know you and to see how you are as mothers. And, oh, you know, just like she was gentle, so generous soul. And yeah, very
well,
gentle.
The way her art is, yeah. And the what she wanted to come across in her art. I remember when I learned about her, I felt so like guilty in a way of like, wow, this narrative about her fucking up the Beatles is pushed so hard that like, I didn't even give a shit about the Beatles and I knew about that narrative.
And they had already decided to break up. That's the thing. Like, right. If you actually look at the timeline, the Beatles were already, just had already decided to break up before John and Yoko even met.
Right. And you look at the documentary and you can see that, yeah. The Disney, but this is the narrative that's built on women, like, yeah, you know, yeah. Like you're the person that broke it up.
Fault.
You're
as if we have that power. We wish,
yeah.
You know,
yeah. Because trust me, we wouldn't use it for that. Right. I wouldn't use it to break up the Beatles. I'd use it for something better.
Yeah, insane. Well, thank you so much for being here today.
Yes,
and thanks for paving the way. I mean,
appreciate
listening to the story,
girl.
About Bust. I mean, it's obviously like, well, if that hadn't come, things like Guys We Fucked wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
So thank you,
Marcel,
for doing that. And I'm glad that you're in Wikipedia.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Definitely pick up Getting Over Max Cooper. Is there a place where it would be best for people to buy from, like your website or?
It's online at all of the places.
And you don't have a preferred way, just anyway.
Anyway, it's
good. Getting Over
it's
Max
at your
Cooper.
Local bookstore. Support the local bookstores, but yeah. It's also at the big ones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank
this
you,
has been
thank
Guys
you, thank
We
thank
Fuck,
you,
the
you.
Anti-Slut Shaming Podcast. We will talk to you next Friday. Guys We Fucked is presented by Luminary.
Created and hosted by Corinne Fisher and Christina Hutchinson.
Editing and music coordination by Mike Coscarelli. Theme song by Rob Patterson and Jake Kozen.
Suck my wet ass pussy.
Christina said to cut that before, but now it's in there.
Yeah, let's keep it. Who cares?
Don't seem to believe.